Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM, Seattle. The best in true crime, conspiracy, and history with Al Warren and Kev Thompson.
You are back in the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm your host, Al Warren, and Kevin is back.
Hey, I am here.
Yeah, Mr. Sick Man. Mr. Flu Man. I can't believe how many people were sick this last week. With the flu.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, we had to reschedule an interview, in fact.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, actually, even Dave was, yeah. So, now, and we want to thank a couple of new stations, KVFX 98.3 FM in Utah, as well as KYAH, I can't say that, KYAH. In 5:40 a.m. Salt Lake, because they've joined the family and they're airing us now 5 days a week at 4 o'clock Mountain Time. It's fantastic to have some new listeners, new stations, and hopefully they'll keep listening. Now today we are talking with Ron Francell. He is a noted author of several books, The Darkest Night, Morgue, Delivered from Evil, Outlaw Los Angeles, just an incredible amount of reading. You want to read his books. So welcome, Ron.
Well, thank you for having me, and hello to all your new Utah listeners.
Yeah, hopefully they like us.
Let's hope. I'm sure they will.
Well, you know, true crime is a big thing everywhere, even in Utah. And
yes, it is.
And now, did you know it's illegal to threaten somebody with an unloaded gun in Texas?
No, I didn't know that, but given the number of guns in Texas, I would say being illegal is the least of the person's problem. They could be shot down by 4 or 5 bystanders before we get to the legal question. So.
I started to say, is there such a thing as an unloaded gun in Texas?
True. Maybe it's illegal to point an unloaded gun because it's just stupid.
Well, I just love it, because now we get this from Factinate, which is a website that talks about weird or old laws that are still on the books that haven't been updated. It's kind of crazy, some of them like that. So I guess you're in Texas. You carry a loaded gun all the time?
Well, no, I don't, but I'm aware of all the people who do, and... It's both frightening and comforting at the same time. You know, if something's going to happen in the theater or in the restaurant, I'm pretty confident that somebody in the room can shoot back. It's not going to be me, but I'm sure it could be. But on the other hand, I'm not so sure of a lot of these people, so they might be the problem more than the solution. So I don't know.
Yeah, I guess that would be a big problem in a sense. How would you determine who you can trust or not trust in a case like that?
Well, sure.
You know, that would be the weird thing. I know in the last book that I finished that went out about the Australian killers, like the Port Arthur mass shooting, that was a big problem when he was running around shooting people. In fact, people would stop because they thought the shooter was running to get away, and they'd stop their car to pick him up, and then he would shoot them. So it's kind of, I think it confused a lot of people there. So
I wrote about the Luby's Cafeteria massacre in 92 here in Killeen, Texas, and in which a mass murderer named George Henard crashes his truck into the Luby's Cafeteria, crashes through the plate glass window and comes to rest in the middle of the dining room. People are stunned by this, thinking somebody's had a heart attack, but in a moment he gets out of his car and starts shooting people, point blank. Among the people in the restaurant is a woman named Susanna Hupp, and Susanna has a license to carry, but in Texas at the time it was illegal to bring your gun into a restaurant. She had it in her car, but not in her purse where it normally was. Early in this massacre, she had the chance, was only 6 feet away from the shooter, and had the chance to have shot him if she had had her gun. She didn't, and he went on to kill 23 people. And there's an example of the good guy with a gun might be able to limit the death, the body count, if you will, if they have that chance. In her case, she didn't have that chance. In Texas today, she would, but let's hope she doesn't have to. We have examples on both sides. We have the example of the fellow who ended the Sutherland, very recent Sutherland Springs massacre here in Texas. The good guy with a gun is real. It really happens. It's not as big a story maybe in the media, but it does happen. And arguments can be made for wider gun ownership. I also hear the arguments against wider gun ownership. I'm not an ardent supporter or opponent of either. But as a student of mass murder for the last 10 years, I see a lot of examples where wider gun ownership prevented deaths.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I'm kind of in between. I hear both stories. I think it sort of has to be done to fit the country or the state that does it, because some countries can work really, really well with pretty strict gun control, whereas I don't think the states would get away with it. I don't think it would work.
Well, and I think it's the kind of is a kind of decision that should rest in state law. I believe what Massachusetts or Connecticut might want to do is certainly different than what Texas or Wyoming is inclined to do. I think that in most cases, I believe that kind of decision lies with the states. And certainly on crime, those are the people who are responding are local law enforcement. The FBI doesn't rush to the scene of a mass shooting unless the FBI office happens to be next door. It's local law enforcement, and I think that those kinds of laws and those kinds of sensibilities lie generally with the states.
Now, having said that, I take it that you don't see any chance for national reciprocity with everybody recognizing carry concealed.
I think there's some wisdom in it, but I can't imagine Connecticut thinking that the guy to whom Texas gives the right to carry a gun should be allowed to come to Connecticut and enjoy the same protections. So, I would give that a low chance. I don't disagree with the idea, but again, we get back to to individual states being able to determine how that's going to go. I don't think we should inflict Texas's sensibilities on Connecticut or vice versa.
Mm-hmm. So, when you write about mass crimes, what is it that you look for when you what part of the story is most intriguing to you?
The book that I did about mass killings, that which included serial killers and mass murderers and spree killers, I was looking for one thing. I was looking for survivors who had put their lives back together. And that was a harder hunt than you might think. I was looking for people who exhibited that kind of resilience that we hope we would have if we were in that situation. If we survived an attack by a terrorist or a mass murderer or a serial killer, we want to believe that we could put our lives back together, restore some semblance of normalcy, and live out our days. The hard part of that was that out of 60 survivors of mass murders over the past 70 years that I could identify, I would say that there were only between 12 and 15 that I would say had put their lives back together. So in that case, I was looking for a survivor who was reasonably readjusted to life. That's a rare thing. In general, when I write about crime, though, I'm looking for a bigger story. I'm looking for something that reflects our culture, our humanity, something more than just a salacious, bloody story with shocking photos. That market exists, and I don't judge, but I'm looking to tell a deeper story that has some literary chances for me, and so in general, I just want to tell a good story that's meaningful. It's not just exploitive. It means something at the end.
Yeah, it sounds like it sounds like you're wanting to write about the resilience of the human spirit after a tragedy.
Well, certainly in Delivered from Evil, that was a theme. That was the theme, was resilience. And my interest, and many of my colleagues in crime writing's interest, is in the victim. The victim who dies can be very, very interesting, but the victim who survives has a quality to me that's fascinating. In my book, The Darkest Night, about the crime, a horrible crime against two of my childhood friends when we were kids, has two victims, sisters, who were abducted and terrorized, raped, and then thrown off a very high bridge into a very deep canyon. One dies, and one survives. And the book becomes ultimately about the one who survived and the horror of living after a crime. Dying is bad enough. Living with the horror after a crime can be worse.
That must really kind of devastate the community as well.
Oh, sure. I think that the smaller the town, the more devastating a horrible crime is. In that particular case, this is a crime that's alive in the memory of that small town, even today, 40-something years after it happened. In fact, the New York Daily News just had a story about that crime this past weekend. It's lying there very close to the surface, not only in the memory, but in the history of the place. And I think that when you drop a stone into the water, it sends forth all these ripples. Well, so the crime is a stone, and we drop it out there into our history, and it sends forth these ripples that reverberate over generations into the future. I'm on Facebook today, and 40, I'm going to add it up here, almost 45 years later, I've had a second and third generation of the killer's family reach out to me through modern technology and social media with questions that are startling about, is this in their DNA? Do they have tendencies? 45 years later, think about that. And so the reverberation of these crimes over time is fascinating. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a criminologist. I'm not a sociologist. I'm just an observer. I'm a journalist. But I'm fascinated by that. And I would like for sociologists and a psychologist and a criminologist to reach out to me and tell me why this is. But from a storyteller's perspective, it's important because it's reflecting us to us. And I think a book has no greater purpose, and maybe especially in true crime, than leaving us with something more than a titillation. I don't like the typical supermarket true crime, because I think it's too salacious and too exploitive. I want to tell a story, and I want that story to mean something and to reflect who we are, so that if we need to, we can change. Truman Capote started that. People like Vincent Bugliosi and James Ellroy have continued that, or did continue it. But I think that's very important. I don't think true crime can be just about bloody pictures and salacious testimony and grim autopsy reports. I think it has to speak to our hearts.
What do you think about the reporting by groups that suggest that none of these mass killings ever happened? They were false flags and
False flags.
Yeah, created by the government, yeah. just to take away guns and or whatever the point behind it would be. But basically, there were actors and none of these things have happened.
As a journalist for my entire life, any manipulation of the truth is abhorrent to me. I don't care who you are, and I don't care what your position is. If you've manipulated the truth to make a point, you're just a common liar, and you ought to be treated as a common liar. So any of those, regardless of the point they're trying to make it with the truth or go away. It's unfortunate that technology and social media have given those people a place to stand. I weep for us, the readers and the listeners and the viewers, who aren't sure now what's true and what isn't true. And that goes beyond the false flag people, and it goes into some of the mainstream media right now. But if we can't make our point with facts, then the point shouldn't be made. And that's just the journalist in me, the old school journalist in me. I probably couldn't get hired in a newspaper today with an attitude like that.
They wouldn't let you in. So
they wouldn't.
So what do you think about that last one, the Vegas killing? There's been so much talk about that. Do you feel like it was a cover-up, or how did you read that?
No, I don't feel there's a cover-up. You know what? The mass murders in history from 1949, when the first real public mass shooting was, to today. So we'll use that as our frame of reference. We always latch on to the mass murders that add some new little wrinkle. The 49 was Howard Unruh. This is the first time somebody walks around and kills people with a gun. This is huge. I guarantee you the same questions were asked in the Philadelphia newspapers the very next day that we ask now. We just ask them faster because we have that technology now. By 1965, when Charles Whitman climbs up the tower of the University of Texas and starts killing people, that becomes big news because he went up a tower. 84, we have James Hubert, he goes into a McDonald's, a place where we're supposed to feel safe, and he kills a bunch of people. George Hennard in 91 or 92, whenever it was, drives his truck through the plate glass window of a cafeteria and kills people. Cho at the West Virginia, or Virginia Tech, I'm sorry, it goes up and down the campus killing people. The guy in Las Vegas was really just the latest in that too long line of ordinary lunatics who thought he could be somebody or be something or wanted to do something. And he did. We don't know. He died. We don't. We've seldom known the motives of these killers because they mostly die. When they live and they tell us why they did it, we almost always have said, that doesn't make sense. That's stupid. Because it is. They're lunatics. They don't think logically. They don't think rationally. And we want to apply logic and rationality to these things. They don't exist. These are nutcases. They're whack jobs. And we're always disappointed when we learn what motivated them to do something. We say it doesn't make sense. If we knew what the Las Vegas shooter's motive really was, we'd still be dissatisfied because it won't make sense. I guarantee you, it won't make sense. The fact is, he blew his brains out, and we don't have any evidence of his motive. That's not a cover-up. We don't know. That's not a conspiracy. It's just they don't know. And the fact is, that's been the experience of the last, 70 years. We have seldom known. Occasionally, we've been so eager to know, we've made stuff up. the Howard Unruh, who actually lived in 1949, was said to be just a soldier with combat fatigue or shell shock or PTSD, which wasn't named at that time. The fact is, that wasn't it at all. But what people will say about him. People will say Charles Whitman climbed that tower in Texas because he had a brain tumor. Well, that's not why he did it. It completely ignores a fabulously abusive childhood, mental problems that went from here to there. But we want easy, quick answers that make sense to us. The fact is, most of the time, they're not quick, they're not easy, and they don't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to... I don't know, for some reason it puts people at ease if they can just come up with the answer. You know.
That's right. Well, want to know why. That's the most human thing... it's the most human thing. Why is a natural and a human question? I'm not a psychologist, as I said before. I'm a journalist. And I've spent these past 10 or 12 years wading around in these kinds of stories. Nobody wants to know the answers more than the survivors and the loved ones of the dead people. While it might be natural for us to want to know, we've got to be patient. We've leapt to those quick conclusions that I talked about, and we were wrong. And in our impatience, I think sometimes we've missed our opportunity to truly understand something about these killers. So I patience is warranted, but patience isn't something we do well, we humans. And certainly we modern media consumers. But patience is exactly what we need right now.
Well, that's probably where conspiracy theories abound. Because, like you said, you know, what they do is utter madness. So the solution has got to be fast and just as equally crazy.
That's right. Exactly. You're absolutely right. And, you know, my book, Delivered from Evil, which was about the survivors of mass killers, came out on the same day of the Gabby Giffords shooting in Tucson, Arizona. And because of that, because of that coincidence, I'm fresh meat for national news programs, among them CNN, who is calling... 3 and 4 hours after the crime, wanting to interview me. But they wanted me to comment on how the killer was inspired by right-wing talk radio to attack a Democrat.
Rush Limbaugh made me do it.
And they referred me to his online writings and everything. And I looked at his online writings, and I really saw no evidence of that. They saw what they wanted to see, but I didn't see that evidence. Instead, I got on that night, and they asked their question, and I said, no, I think he's a garden variety lunatic with a gun. He wasn't aiming at the congresswoman in particular. He shot a Republican judge. He shot a bunch of people that he didn't know what they were. He's a garden variety lunatic with a gun. They said, thank you, and cut me off, you know. So,
well, yeah.
That's fine. And now we know Jared Lochner was a garden variety lunatic with a gun. It had nothing to do with Rush Limbaugh or right-wing talk radio or political hate.
Yeah.
Jared Lochner was MK Ultra.
Yeah, because I got attacked on that from a cop that I was interviewing who said that, you know, the same as the Vegas shooter was an anti-Trump, and he was brainwashed by Antifa, anti-fascist, and they called him on the phone in the hotel and said a word to him, and then that made him blast off. And I said that, I told him that I thought that was absolutely ridiculous, you know, but he said that it's people like me that are ruining the country. And I was like, well,
wear that badge of honor.
Well, I was just asking the question of, it's like, well, where did you get that from? And basically, there's no evidence of that. You might think that, and you might think he looks like that, or whatever drew you to that conclusion, or you heard it on Alex Jones or whatever. But how about some evidence before you do that? I also heard that Hillary Clinton was on the fourth floor of the Mandalay Bay, and she's the one that called him. So,
the media in the wake of all of these things has tended, and I've seen it going back to 1949, has always been breathless. It's always been impatient. And it has made people breathless and impatient. And we can go down the list of these terrible things and see in the backwash, we can see some of the lunacy of our own culture in dealing with it. That's why I say patience is warranted. If we can take a deep breath and let these cops do what they do, we more often than not will get answers, or we will be convinced that there are no answers to be gotten. In the Vegas shooter's case, I think we might never know his motive. And to a certain degree, I don't really care, because whatever they come up with, whatever, if they did have a motive, whatever they would tell us, we would simply not be satisfied with. That's the fact, and I'm not especially interested in the motive of these people. If we can know it, then fine. If we can trust it, then fine. If we can use it to prevent another one, then fine. But if we have to argue about it, then it's not really going to help. Our point in knowing the motive of Charles Whitman or George Henard or Cho or James Huberty or the Vegas shooter should be directed solely to preventing this thing from happening in the future. Most of the time, it's not going. When we know, if we know a motive, it's not going to be helpful to us. To know it, because it's going to seem rather weird. So, to your original question, making stuff up never helps. Using the platforms we now have in social media and technological media can be good, but unfortunately, there's just a lot of people out there that use it for bad purposes, and that's too bad. But that's a reality.
Now, would you say that there's a difference, though, between trying to understand the motives of a spree killer, or, and I'm trying to word this very carefully, and understanding what they're doing? For example, you know, we've got the Mandalay Bay shooter. We understand what happened. But then you've got the Malvo case, where you've got an adult that's almost mentoring, almost trying to recreate himself in a younger man, and right. takes this boy on a shooting spree that crossed several states. Do we not need to understand how that can happen? Well, what made Malvo so vulnerable, and what was it about him that he got selected?
I think the division that you're trying to make in your question is appropriate, that in cases like the Muhammad Malvo case, it is important for us to know. In this case, we have both of them, and we can analyze them, and we can explore their psychology, and we can come to some of these conclusions. I guarantee you that you and I and those like us in the crime writing or the crime psychology world find this important. The great arrested for shooting white people.
Mm-hmm.
And they drew their conclusions with that. Knowing Muhammad and Malvo's psychology and their reasons and their motives and their methods is important. Absolutely important. And it's fascinating. Like I said earlier, knowing the story is fascinating to me because it reflects us. I took that a step further, by the way, and believe that John Allen Muhammad was influenced by an earlier mass murder in New Orleans in 1973 that he saw as a little kid. And it was a racial incident, and I believe that Muhammad was influenced by that. But the example that you pick is outstanding, because there's where we can actually use what we learn to maybe forestall this in the future.
Mm-hmm.
A lot was learned from John Allen Muhammad and Boyd Malvo. A lot has been done to adjust. A lot has been done to improve our methods for tracking serial killers like that. So I don't mean to leave the impression that it's not important to know. I just trying to make the point that for the great bulk of people, knowing the motive of the Las Vegas shooter will be meaningless, because they'll scratch their heads and say, well, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
It will make sense. Ops and to hotel keepers and to crime writers. Maybe not the logic of it, but we'll see how it can help to know. Everybody else. And actually, we're past it. I believe we're past it. That knowing the motive of the Vegas shooter is old news now. It was a news story for a few days, and then everybody's attention shifted to something else. And if we come up with a story now, and we find a note that he wrote, or a diary entry, or a video, or whatever that he left. And we can say, you know, with some assurance that this was his motive. A lot of people go, that's interesting. You know, what did Trump say today?
Yeah.
You know, I sound cynical because I am cynical about the general public and its lack of attention, its the shortness of its attention, and the shallowness of its understanding. I should say, the shallowness of what they want to understand. You know, that's more it. They want Malvo and Muhammad boiled down into 10 words. And they want it to be racial.
And it's never that simple.
It's never that simple. So, when we talk about the Vegas shooter, when we talk about the Sutherland Springs shooter, and that their ilk, we don't want an exhaustive explanation. We're like Hollywood. We want a 20-line summary of this movie. We don't want the script. You know, I don't want the book. I want the 20-line summary, the 20-word summary.
Well, that brings up a really good point, Ron. Have we been trained that way, that an entire crime can be solved in 44 minutes? You know,
absolutely.
It's an episode of CSI.
Yes. Right. There's such a thing that exists in criminology and in jurisprudence known as the CSI effect, where I think it has a lot of applications, but it was mainly introduced to describe juries who say, what do you mean you don't have DNA evidence? I mean, they have it on CSI, and they get it every day. How come you don't have it? Or how come you couldn't find out what kind of pizza he ordered on July 6th, 1968. I mean, Abby on NCIS can call that up in 10 seconds. This, yes. This expectation, a common people, juries specifically, that technology is far greater than it really is, is known as the CSI effect. So, absolutely. And when we're sitting at home or talking to our friends, forget being on a jury. We have this expectation that Hollywood was telling us the truth, when really Hollywood almost never tells us the truth. But we think it. We think that they couldn't put it on there if it wasn't true. So yes, absolutely. We are trained to think that we can determine what pizza you had 38 years ago on a specific date, because we think that was stored someplace in a computer. And if that's true, then some benevolent hacker can get in there and find out what it was.
Yes.
Well, but hasn't that been kind of going on for years? Because the whole JFK assassination, I think a lot of the, I don't know, how a lot of what's behind it is people thinking, how could we not know what happened? How could someone shoot the president? And we don't know. There has to be a conspiracy. Isn't that sort of a kind of...
That's the point. We do know. I mean, it's this unwillingness that some punk, some deluded punk with a gun could change history. So we say, the Warren Commission says, Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK, and here's how he did it. Well, we don't want to believe that. So we say, well, we don't have the facts, and we make up stories.
But it was that easy with Lincoln. What's the difference?
There are Lincoln conspiracy theories. And now, we're not generally familiar with them. But there are Lincoln conspiracy theories. And it's just, we've just moved on from Lincoln. We haven't moved on from JFK. We're not going to move on from Donald Trump. You know, not our lifetimes.
No.
And so, you know, history has a way of lapsing, and we have a way of ignoring history. So, but there are Lincoln conspiracy theories. In JFK's case, we do know what happened. It's just the insistence by the public on not believing that says, that causes us to say, we don't know the facts. And the fact is, we do know the facts. The facts are pretty solidly known and verified. But we just are reluctant to believe that a punk with a gun, a nobody, a little man, changed history by shooting a great man. And there had to be something more. I've said it many times. Maybe the CIA did want to kill him. Maybe the Cubans wanted to kill him. Maybe the Russians wanted to kill him. They might have all had gunmen in Dealey Plaza that day. The fact is, they all missed except Lee Harvey Oswald. So, there might have been all those enemies willing to target and wanting to target JFK. But they all missed that day except for Lee Harvey Oswald. So I think a lot of this is not a flaw in the crime solving and the crime the sleuthing, but a crime in the crime a flaw in the crime consumer. You know, I've run into it with my own stories where you see the pieces of paper, you see the pictures, you know what happened, and you say it, and somebody will step forward and say, that's not true. Something else happened, because that's what they want to believe.
And it sells books.
Yeah,
and then they come out with their own book, maybe, and how many books are out there on the JFK assassination? It should be telling that how many pages of secret, quote-unquote secret documents were just released here a few months ago on the JFK assassination. And the most interesting one was about Martin, the most interesting among those documents was about Martin Luther King's sexual appetites.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with JFK's assassination. And there was nothing else that we learned about, nothing new that we learned about JFK's assassination in those other 29,999 documents. But they were secret. And that alone caused a lot of conspiracy theories. But the fact is, there was nothing there. There was no there.
Yeah. Actually, in your book, Morgue, you had a chapter on that where when they actually dug up Oswald's body because they thought it was not his body or something, right?
Right. Well, so again, a conspiracy theory. A respected British journalist named Michael Eddowes wrote a book and floated and made a very eloquent case that Oswald, when he went to Russia, stayed in Russia, and then in his place was sent a look-alike Russian agent whose purpose ultimately was to kill Kennedy. And he makes that case. Well, the only person in the world to whom that could matter and get something done was Marina Oswald, the widow. And she didn't buy into it 100%, but she bought into it enough that she said, let's exhume the body and prove that it is or it isn't. You know, there was talk about how they had burrowed in from another grave and done it sideways and things like
that.
Oh,
wow. They fret Oswald.
My co-author on the book, Morgue, Dr. Vincent DeMaio, was on the team that dug up the casket of Lee Harvey Oswald and peeked inside. And did more than that. They took the remains that were there and used them to determine if it was Lee Harvey Oswald's body or not. Now, since you haven't heard any stories about how it wasn't, I think you could safely assume that they found that Oswald was buried in Oswald's grave. And they did it with sort of classical Sherlockian forensics. They didn't have DNA. They didn't have, you know, things. They just used an X-ray machine and their own eyes. So, but they did confirm it was Oswald. There you have a conspiracy theory that was, you know, sold probably at least hundreds of thousands of books. It just was. Eddowes pulled it out of his southern quarters. That's all.
Well, how do we know they didn't just kill Oswald when they were going to exhume his body, and then they just exchanged the bodies before they could exhume it?
Well, you know, spoken like a true conspiracy theorist.
Well,
we don't know, of course, but but see, that's the classic conspiracy theory thing, that when we prove one isn't true, then usually they take it one step further and say, in a way that says, well, your proof is suspect because this new thing. new idea, this new theory. And we could go and prove that one wrong, and then they would take it one step further. And they just keep moving the goalposts until finally you've got something that ultimately couldn't happen. I mean, not if you had 1,000 monkeys typing. They would come up with Macbeth before they would actually solve this crime the way you would like it solved. So, have there been cover-ups in criminal cases? Yes. They're not usually. You're giving government or law enforcement more credit than they deserve for being that smart in most cases.
Yeah.
that's the usual thing. The more people that get involved, if you think about Kennedy, how many different people would have had to be involved in that kind of a thing? And that, you know, 50-something years later, we still haven't heard anything from any of them that says, oh, hey, I have proof that it didn't happen that way.
Yeah, so, it's an endless cycle. It really is. What was the most, let's say, of the books you've written, what was the most, I don't know, I don't want to say shocking, but what has stayed with you the longest out of all those books?
Well, I think The Darkest Night, was because it was so intimate to me and because it was so personal, these were two young girls who were my next door neighbors, and we were all innocent. And because it so vastly and swiftly changed the culture of this little town where we lived, that is probably by definition the most personal and continues to be the most influential to me. I think that in Delivered from Evil, I went out to find these survivors to see what we could learn from them. Because we've not all been victims of a mass killer, or would be victims of a mass killer of some kind, but we've been divorced. We've not gotten a job. We have our own disappointments and our own traumas.
That's the work. Boy.
As you know, as a writer, that writing is fun. Having written is more fun.
Yeah. I agree with that. Well, Ron, it's always good having you on. It's always good conversation. We can talk about almost anything. And,
yes, we can.
We almost did.
I think I only shocked you once. So.
Yeah.
Well, it's been another good episode, and we hope you continue to listen. And our guest today has been Ron Francell. We'll have his books up on the website as well. And thank you very much.
Ron, thank you.
And again, good luck. We love being on your show, and I'm glad to hear you're adding listeners everywhere.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.